The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor.
And I'm Gus Carter, The Spectator's deputy features editor.
This week we're going to be discussing Scotland's new hate crime bill, profiling the man who could be France's next prime minister, and asking whether directors should meddle with Shakespeare.
So, Will, we're speaking on Thursday lunchtime. The magazine went to press yesterday. Our cover line is War on Words, is Scotland ready for its new hate crime law? Can you talk us through how this idea came about?
Well, on April 1st, April Fool's Day, in Scotland, the Hate Crime and Public Order Act comes into effect. And what that means is that the offence of stirring up racial hatred is going to be extended to include disability, religion, sexual orientation, and other characteristics. And the new law doesn't give many assurances at all for protecting free speech, which is something that our editor Fraser, obviously, as a Scotsman himself, is very passionate about.
As a member of the Scottish Mafia.
As a member of the Scottish Mafia, he's very passionate about this. And we asked Lucy Hunter Blackburn to write about it because she's a former senior member of the Scottish Civil Service, so is very well placed to criticise where this act has gone wrong. And it felt a particularly good week to do it now, not just because obviously it takes effect in April, but because the Scottish government has just released this really bizarre public awareness campaign featuring a hate monster, which is intended to shed some light on what this is all going to entail, but actually makes things, I think, much more confusing. Let's have a listen to what the Scottish government's little hate monster has to say.
You might know this thing here. It's the hate monster. When you're feeling insecure, when you feel angry, he'll be there, feeding off the emotions. Getting bigger and bigger till he's weighing you down. He'll make you want to have a go at somebody. A neighbour, somebody on the street, on a night out, security guy on the door, somebody in the chippy, your taxi driver. He'll make you want to vent your anger, just because folk look or act different for you. The hate monster wants you to feel what you need to show. You're better than them. Then, before you know it, you've committed a hate crime. Don't feed the hate monster.
So we spoke to Lucy earlier about her piece, along with Baroness Claire Fox, unaffiliated peer and founder of the Academy of Ideas think tank. I started by asking Lucy why we should be concerned about this new act.
Before you've stirred up racial hatred, you have to do something which the law regards as either abusive or threatening. And these are quite broad, well, threatening less so, but abusive is quite a broad term. And in an area like transgender identity, people have wildly different views about what is or is not abusive. So that's your starting point, people's perceptions of abuse. So the law rests on a reasonable person thinking something is abusive. But we had the principal of Edinburgh University reporting stickers to the police a few years ago, because he that said things like adult human female on campus. Was he a reasonable person? We have Justin Webb, who was found at fault by the BBC complaints, the Executive Complaints Unit, I think it's called, for explaining to viewers, listeners rather, that a trans woman is a male person. You know, it's a BBC Complaints Unit staffed with reasonable people. You know, what is a reasonable person's view of abuse? So that the threshold seems to us wildly open to interpretation, and it's a difficult job for the police. The bill does have some protection for freedom of expression. It says discussion or criticism of matters is a defence you can use. But again, where does that stop? Where does discussion and criticism stop and abuse start in this particular area? In other areas, it may be easier. But around transgender identity, there is a massive range of views. And we can see on social media, people sort of lining up to say they're going to report people who disagree with them, who disbelieve that gender identity is a thing that should replace sex. So that's the root of our concern, is that this kind of language is far too vague, and that Lord Bracadale, when he recommended the extension of stirring up, said that there should be defences, which are more like the ones in the English legislation for sexual orientation when it was added in England, which are specific about the kind of things that are not in the scope of the law. The law is not here to stop you saying this, that, or the other. And for religion, it's a bit closer. The religious protection of freedom of expression in the Act in Scotland is more like the English one, and a bit more wide, you know, a bit clearer that it's not trying to do things. But in Scotland, we see massive scope for the police. What do the police do? Is the question. How do they triage out stuff in this area? And how do they make legal judgments? But how, given what we know about the degree of training, the relationships between the police and lobby groups, how confident are any of us that the police will apply a test that really leaves space? Well, not very confident is the answer, but it's really, the confidence is very low.
Claire, the obvious question to ask is what is currently legal that would then become illegal on the 1st of April? Actually, answering that question seems quite hard with this law.
Well, it's partly because of the broad way that hate crime legislation in general has been applied perfectly unreasonably, in my view, to anyone who says something that you subjectively find offensive or hateful and that you can report. The campaigns that those of us who are involved in free speech might have said would be to have put pressure on the police to not investigate every time anyone complains of hate. In this instance, in the new Scottish Hate Bill situation, or Hate Act situation, the police have promised that they will investigate every single complaint. That's difficult. But I have to say that I'm not a great legal mind. It's an understatement of the year. But I think that the phrase stirring up frightens me. Because stirring up is where effectively you have a strong opinion on something. I assume it's kind of, it indicates more than just writing something or saying something. But for those of us who do have strong opinions, and actually I'd want to encourage in a political sense, strong opinions to be expressed. And in a democratic society, that's what the public square should be full of. Strong opinions being exchanged because you're trying to persuade someone else. And you just know that anyone who's got that strong opinion and tries to convince somebody else of it will be stirring up. There's that aspect to it. The other peculiarity of the law, which is very dangerous, is that it makes no distinction between the private and the public spheres at all.
Yes.
So it goes to great lengths to emphasise this might be something you say in your own home, in a private meeting, to, you know, it might be something you say casually. I mean, they use examples like to a security guard. I don't know why you'd be, but, you know, it's like, it's almost like in passing, anyone you encounter in any circumstance can complain that they are a victim of you stirring up hatred. And that will inevitably mean that people are looking over their shoulder. It's also the case that they have set up these third party or these places that you can go in and report your concerns. So it's basically creating a nation of snitches. Explicitly, we already have a fair amount of that. It can mean that children will report on their own parents. I mean, what could possibly go wrong encouraging teenagers to say that you can anonymously report somebody stirring up, you know, and so on and so forth? I mean, people will obviously use this in a malicious way. I don't mean vast swathes of them, but sufficiently it allows malicious complaints, and it's absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. Well, something you bring up very well, I think, in your piece, Lucy, is there's two main problems here, it seems to me. One is the broadness of the remit of the Act itself, and then the other is the secrecy of the approach of Police Scotland, that we just don't know yet exactly how Police Scotland are going to enforce this law once it comes into effect. But there's some pretty worrying leaks, aren't they? I mean, for example, the leaked guidance suggesting that perhaps even stand-up comics and actors could be in trouble, and that threatening and abusive material could be communicated through, and I'm quoting here, through public performance of a play. I mean, this is pretty worrying stuff, isn't it?
So when this was discussed in committee and the issue came up about performances, the government was very strong and said, we couldn't have a situation, they said, following their own logic through really all the way. I mean, it's It's a logical deduction that if you think people shouldn't be allowed to issue pamphlets or hold public meetings in which certain things are said, they can't get round that by putting on a play. So literally, the then Justice Secretary Humza Yousaf invoked the idea of a group of people from the far right putting on a play to get round to convey messages. So that, you know, that's their logic. I mean, I think that the worry about the police training that we're seeing coming out is that we saw, well, yesterday, or today actually, I think in the Telegraph, there's a story about materials that were put in front of the police by the LGBT staff network. That staff network in the police is funded by Police Scotland using, I think, money direct, which comes from Scottish Government. That network sat in a room and put up materials which allowed a group to come in and put up materials which explicitly suggested that a social influencer called Joe, who has a large following, would go around universities and then suddenly out of nowhere will suggest that people should be put in gas chambers. So it's clearly trying to construct a view that the kind of women who hold these views are the kind of people who might do that. I mean, it's mad. It's completely implausible. No, there is no example that looks like that. And that tells you, and somebody sat in the room, a senior-ish, I assume, police officer must have sat in that room and let that be done. And nobody said, hang on a second. And then you get to the fact that the formal training for the Act is a black box. None of us know what it says, but it's only 2 hours of online training. So that's there's not a lot of space there to spend time knocking around how to apply freedom of speech protections. There is some backup support and workshops, but most officers, I mean, we know how overstretched. The Scottish Police are currently, spent the last 6 months making very dramatic statements about how very bad their budget position is, and they're looking at how they can reduce what they do in other areas. So all this is coming in an environment where what the police will do is unknown, but what we do know is that they have very close relationships with people who have worked very hard over many years to press for a really kind of broad definition of hate. So, I mean, Claire mentioned stirring up, and of course the whole phrase is stirring up hate. Well, again, just like abuse, hate is a hugely contested term. You spend 20 minutes on the internet to see that. So none of this, it just feels hugely high risk. It might be fine. Maybe it will be fine. Maybe individual police officers will be extremely cautious. But we are left in the hands of that judgment. The safety nets is what is. This is like a high wire act piece of legislation in which the government refused to put in better safety nets. That's how I describe it.
Mm. Lucy, you mentioned there the concept of stirring up, and Claire mentioned it too. It seems to me that kind of relies on a third party interpreting what someone says. So actually the intention is taken away from the speaker, or rather it's disregarded by the law. And the question kind of at issue is what a third party hears, That seems to me to be the kind of operative element of this legislation.
Not quite, actually. I think it is important to because my complaint is with the law. I do want to say it is your intention to stir up hate. They will have to convict you.
Right. Okay.
They will have to prove that you intended. So the formulation is that a reasonable person would judge that what you said was either abusive or threatening, and I think that's a test. We have no idea how that will work. But that also that you intended to stir up hate. So the worry that people have, for example, just to explain how that might play out, is that I say something that someone judges is abusive. They persuade the police that it's abusive. So then the police are obliged to have a look at my intentions. And before I know it, they've got a warrant under subsection 5. And they're after my, they want to look at my social media, they want to look at my WhatsApp chats, because they want to see what I intended. And a lot of people are very worried that the police, once they feel that they've passed the threshold that they should investigate your intention, but how do they do that? They will probably do it by taking your stuff. It's a feeling. And, these days, living without your phone or your computer, even for a week, let alone months, it's massively, massively intrusive and massively difficult. So it's
I wanted to say, I mean, that would actually chime in with what's happening in Ireland with their hate crime legislation, where they've actually put on the face of the bill that they can confiscate your equipment to indeed ascertain your intention. So I don't think it's far-fetched to imagine that could be part of the mind-reading methods that they use. Mm. How can we prove it? But I also wanted to speak in defence of a conscious, open stirring up of hatred. I mean, which I think is, can be legitimate. I want to now say that I fully intend over the next period of time and have done to stir up hatred against Islamism because I think that it's a great threat to democratic life, to democratic norms and so on and so forth. I say that with some nervousness, but I know that there will be people who will say that means that I'm trying to stir up hatred against Muslims. And we've seen these kind of confusions happening all the time. But you can be consciously trying to stir things up and it not make you a bad person. But certainly it should be allowed in the course of a democratic discussion that you are allowed to hate certain things, certain ideas, and to say them. I think it's, from my point of view, important that we also recognise that this could capture a whole wide range of people. Obviously, and to her great credit, J.K. Rowling, who's been threatened by a leading light in Scotland's law scene, has been told that, you know, her misgendering could well be make her somebody that the police should investigate and so on. But it's beyond just the gender critical question. And you were asking about what do we know about what the police will do. Well, what one the police have done, which is not private, is they brought out this cartoonish nonsense of the hate monster, this kind of red furry monster that, with their own words, talks to these Scottish public as though they're all children. But Lucy, as you explain in the article, and I think this is an important point, when they talk about who's likely to be, you know, have this hate monster whispering in their ear, we discover that they've decided that this is young people between the ages of 18 to 30, young men specifically, and they go on to describe a particular type of young men. Basically, they mean the white working class, young white working class people. And we know that there will be all sorts of prejudices such as this who are being targeted. So it's both. So the police already have in mind the people who won't be able to resist the hate monster whispering in their ear. The only other thing that I'd say is the one reason why you can always be wary of these issues is they keep making assurances. I mean, the SNP and the government, the Scottish government, that, oh, well, it's all right because we're protecting religious freedom. And I just don't believe a word of it. They're actually, they've used this law to abolish the blasphemy law, which granted has not been used for a very long time, some 19th century law. But on the other hand, actually, it does seem to me to have the whiff of contemporary modern blasphemy about it, because I don't think in general people wander around as religious people stating obviously religious points, right? However, I mean, you know, the general way of being religious in this society is not to go around and quote the Bible left, right and centre. It's not the way it happens. However, it might well inform your moral outlook. That might be why you have a particular view on marriage, why you might have a particular view on same-sex relationships. And however much I might disagree with them and do, religious freedom allows you to have those views. Whereas I think that what's going to happen is that a lot of potentially religious people will find themselves accused of stirring up hatred under this bill, and it will act as a kind of blasphemy bill. I think it's you, Lucy, make the point. They don't even need to arrest anyone under this. They just need to investigate all the crimes of hate. Even if they never prosecute, I hate legislation that's only used as sending a message. But I'm afraid the message this sends is you are not free, either privately in your own home over dinner or chats amongst your WhatsApp mates or anywhere.
Or from your own children,
to speak freely without the state policing you and threatening you with criminal sanction. And that is, I mean, we know that that's not a free society. That is an authoritarian society.
Just finally, Claire, Douglas Murray also writes in this week's magazine about policing crime, or not policing crime, actually. But he's writing about it in an English context, and he makes the point that, yes, these laws are coming into place in Scotland, and dreadful they are. However, he points out that actually, even without these laws, the police in England and Wales often do investigate and punish people for crimes of things they've said on social media. So we, even without these laws coming to place, we have a similar problem among our own police. Do you agree with that?
I think absolutely do agree with that. It's just that the added element of putting it on the face of the law, as it were, makes it more frightening.
Yeah.
But don't get me wrong. I mean, I think we have a general problem of something which I haven't read Douglas's article yet, but will. But one of the things that worries me is that the police, and this is particularly true in Scotland, have already admitted that they're so under-resourced, they're not going to solve any crimes, it seems to me. I mean, they kind of say, you know, like, oh, you know, you've had a break-in, don't bother phoning, unless you've got CCTV evidence and you know the name and address of the person who did it. I mean, we know that from the public's point of view, people feel very insecure at the moment because if you are a victim of crime, you can't rely on the police actually turning... I mean, in traditional crime, you can't rely on the police turning up. But, you know, put the wrong sticker on your front door and they're round in a shot. So it also has the impact, I think, of creating a great disillusion amongst British citizens in England, Scotland or Wales, that the police are not fit for purpose. That they're there, they treat you as the public as the problem because of your views, but they don't protect you. And if you when you're a victim of crime and they're contemptuous of you for who you are, and they're contemptuous of you when you say, I am a victim of crime, can you come around? It's like, no, that's not going to happen. So that is going to damage policing by consent, it seems to me. And it dangerously allows a politicisation of the police force on the one hand, but also lets them off the hook. Yes. I mean, they are there to do a job. And it's really not to issue PR stunts on hate monsters and go around whispering in our ear, the opposite to the hate monster is the nice monster. You must not say that.
Could I come in on some of that?
Yes, please do.
Yeah, so I think there's, well, one point I'll make quickly, and then I want to pick up Claire's point about hate and the law and the use of the law. So it's worth saying that the people who are there, the hate monster, you know, is attributed to one bit of society. The vast majority of people who are going to be subject to petty crimes that the police don't look into further are the same people. It's going to be lads who get beaten up in the street, because we know young men are especially vulnerable to that. It's going to be communities, not necessarily young men, but communities. It's the same communities, essentially. So, but Claire's point's a really important one about hate. What is the role of the state around the concept of hate? Because hate has become a generic thing that the state it says it's trying to stop. So the hate monster is about hate generically. The Hate Hurts campaign, which is the campaign which is running up just now in Scotland, is very strong, which I'll talk about in the article a bit, which is very strong on words. And it's all hate as a general concept. We're against hate, whatever that is. And, you know, Claire makes a valid point, which is, actually, maybe there are some things, maybe hate as an emotion is not a 100% terrible thing. Maybe there are times when the emotion of hate in some circumstances, not in others, is a natural part of political or human discourse. I have never felt so hated since I stepped into the arena on this. The people who keep accusing me of hate seem to me to be very keen on hate, like hating me. You know, and I don't stop them hating me. They clearly hate me. And, you know, this is the irony of this. I've never been in such a hateful environment in my adult life as being accused of it. But there is a really big point about the law and I think Claire makes an interesting point here, which is that what you have is a sort of a let's make the world a nicer place generally. And that's a lot of chat about that going on. And then it's sort of it's codified into law, but in a very, you know, only in, you know, some kinds of hate in the law identify some kinds of hate as much worse than others. But the campaigns talk about hate, and there's generally a mess of thinking here about what the role of the law is, the role of the state, the boundaries of hate or acceptable hate, why some kinds of hate, you know, women are not protected, beliefs are not religious beliefs. So people can be really, you know, a person can stand in the middle of Glasgow with a big sign that says decapitate TERFs, which I would say is stirring up hate against people like me. And I can have two people, one of whom is now a government minister, SNP politician, stand in front of it. They say, I need to say very clearly, they said they didn't know it was there. But, you know, it's at a demo, so we're full of the great and the good. But they're not, in legal terms, stirring up hate, even after the law changes here, because So there's a mess. It's an intellectual mess. And I'm with Claire that there is a kind of laziness here. I would say there's a laziness in the thinking. Which this act sort of sits as a symbol of.
Claire and Lucy, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Thank you. Gus, what did you enjoy from the magazine this week?
I particularly enjoyed Sam McPhail's piece on Total Football. I don't care about football. I don't watch it. But actually, it's really a story about kind of the obsessive pursuit for kind of as close to perfection as you can get within a team sport, which I think is a more kind of interesting and human story. I also enjoyed Guy Stagg's review of On This Holy Island by Oliver Smith, in which he reveals that the summer solstice, where all those druids and hippies turn up at Stonehenge, isn't actually some kind of ancient event or practice. It started in 1974, and the hippies that organised it invited the Pope, the Dalai Lama, John Lennon, and also a handful of British Airways hostesses. What did you enjoy in this week's magazine?
There's a really good and interesting diary by Richard Madeley, the Good Morning Britain host, who always does such a brilliant diary, actually. We get him to do it probably about at least once a year. And he just has this great enthusiasm for writing and sharing his thoughts. And he's such a personality that always comes across in every diary he does. And this one is no exception. And we're going to have a listen from an extract of it read by him now.
To W12 to be in W1A. The spoof TV series on internal BBC politics. What about vanishingly rare UK television species? A comedy that's actually funny. Filmed a special episode for Red Nose Day. It poked genial fun at Lenny Henry's final appearance as comic relief host after nearly 40 years at the helm. I featured as myself, cockily pitching for his job in front of an increasingly outraged Lenny. Richard Curtis's script was hilarious, but filming was a surreal experience. Not because I was in the same room as the W1A cast, all in character, as appalling BBC apparatchiks, but because we really were in the equivalent of W1A. The BBC's offices in Wood Lane, Shepherd's Bush. Art imitating life, imitating art. I guess it felt weird because, as anyone who's been there will tell you, there really is a BBC atmosphere about the place. You feel it. You almost smell it the moment you walk through the door. The ambiance is utterly different to the other half of Television Centre, which of course is now occupied by ITV and shows such as Good Morning Britain and This Morning. There, it's all hustle, bustle and a sort of commercial flashiness. But inside the BBC tent, there's a kind of haughty torpor, a steady state aura of unmistakable entitlement. All of which lent itself perfectly to our sketch. As Hugh Bonville's smugly self-satisfied executive puts it, whenever corporate catastrophe is just played out under his watch. So, that's all good then.
The next segment is you, Will, talking to Gavin Mortimer, who's written a piece in this week's magazine about Jordan Bardella, who is Marine Le Pen's new number two in the National Rally, her party in France. You spoke to Gavin, as well as Telegraph contributor Anne-Elisabeth Moutet.
Yes, that's right. And I started by asking Gavin to summarise for listeners, who is Jordan Bardella?
Jordan Bardella is 28 years old. He comes from an Italian immigrant family. He grew up in Saint-Saint-Denis, which is in the deprived northern suburb of Paris. He joined the National Front, as it then was, in 2016, when he was still in his teens. And he was quickly identified as someone who was a potential star. The fact that he's young and he comes from Paris, because the National Rally, the National Front, tend to do well in the northeast of France, northern France, and the southeast of France. So I think they saw him as someone who could win them new votes in different areas. And of course, I mean, he became a spokesman for the party in 2018, which is an important year in the evolution of the National Rally. That's when Marine Le Pen changed the name from the National Front to the National Rally. And again, I think that's a sign of how he was identified as the new type of National Rally politician, appealing to a new demographic, because the election failure of 2017, Le Pen has sort of hit a glass ceiling, and she knew that she had to expand into new territories. And then in 2022, he was elected president, an overwhelming majority of 85%, the first time that president of a national rally hasn't been a Le Pen, i.e. Marine or her father, Jean-Marie. And then since then, in the last 18 months, his star has really risen. He's media-friendly, telegenic, and he's intelligent. He's Marine Le Pen is not, in my opinion, a particularly good politician, certainly not a good interviewer or a good debater. She's not too bad pressing the flesh with the general public. So Jordan Bardella has become certainly the media face of the national run.
And Elizabeth, I'd love to know whether you agree with Gavin's analysis of Bardella. Do you think that he could give new life to National Rally? And do you think this is what the party actually needs? I mean, wasn't there this sense after the last presidential election in France that was Le Pen's last stand in a way? And after that, it was sort of all over for her and her party.
I wouldn't say so. And I also wouldn't say that it's her last chance. And I totally agree with Gavin on Bardella. I sort of disagree on her. I think she is a very different politician from Bardella. But she is seasoned, she's experienced, she has a sort of story about her. She is perceived in a very different way by voters and by the people who vote for her than he is. And they are very complimentary. And I think she's absolutely cottoned on to that fact. She is motherly. She is somebody, I think she's actually a good speaker. And I think she's actually a much better interviewer than people think, except that she never does very well with Macron, because Macron hits anybody who tries to debate him on television with his entire inner formatted, you know, how do you not know the statistics about this specific corner of the economy? You know, you've not passed the exam. But it's getting not so good for him now, because people hate this man who's cleverer and has got, you know, he aced every possible exam he passed, and they feel the sort of the contempt that he has for anybody who cannot do that, and that's now perceptible. So I actually think that she's pretty human. She appeals to a kind of voter that's a bit different from Bardella, but that's complementary. Working class people like her, women like her, the people in sort of remote places of what we are calling in France, we used to call La France périphérique. It doesn't mean that it's the periphery of the country. It means that these are places that are peripheral to the regions that are vibrant. You know, small-sized towns in places where you don't have a high-speed train going, deindustrialized places. And there's a whole sort of meaning that's not very well expressed by them, because they belong to a kind of emotion politics that's not necessarily a sort of, you know, extremely expressive kind of politics. But I think that exists in the way that politics is waged on the ground. So I don't think she's finished, because she's going up. At Wednesday, people are trying to pit them against one another. They are perfectly aware of that. She is perfectly aware of that. He is aware of that too. He may have become slightly, sort of, you know, he may be tempted by hubris, because right now he's a massive star. But either they hang together or they'll hang separately.
Hmm. Well, Gavin, I would love to know your thoughts about the professional relationship between Le Pen and Bardella. As Anne Elizabeth said just then, the media loves to have this sense that they're pit against one another. Do you think there's some truth in that? It certainly seems to be a topic of intrigue for the French media.
Well, the person allegedly who is trying to pit them one another, to divide them, is Macron, who was singing Bardella's praise last in November, when there was a meeting of party political leaders, and Bardella turned up. Not all of them turned up, by the way. The leader of the centre-right Republicans and the Socialist Party didn't turn up. But Bardella did, and it was a canny move on his part. But afterwards, Macron let it be known that he was very impressed with him. And there was no chance, Elizabeth, absolutely right, that they complement each other. And there's no chance that Bardella would turn against Le Pen, because the Le Pen family still really control the National Rally. And the ex-vice president, the ex-number two of Marine Le Pen, a man called Florian Philippot, fell out with that. And he runs now a very fringe party. So Bardella, they're together. They complement each other. And in fact, I'm talking to you from the France periphery now, which Anne-Elizabeth described so well. This is in Burgundy. I'm about 100 miles or so southeast of Paris. I've got a couple of builders in as we speak doing some work on my house. They're both Le Pen and Bardella fans, and I've talked to them about them, and they, they like them for different reasons. And Bardella, they think he's smart, he's cool, he appeals very much to the young. He's also a bit of a gay icon, apparently, and he dresses in a way that is deliberately supposed to resemble a young Jack Chirac. So somber suit, somber tie, white tie, slick back hair, just giving the impression of someone in control. And as Anne-Elisabeth said, Marine Le Pen really worked on her, softening her image, talked a lot about cats. She's known within the party as Tatty. And I think their strategy, as we outlined earlier this year to in a media interview, that she'll be president, he'll be prime minister. And I think that's quite an appeal. The one area they've still got to win over is big business.
Well, Anne-Elisabeth, on that point about looking to the future, obviously the presidential the next presidential election is still some ways away. What do you think National Rally would need to do in order to have a better showing at the next election, given that in the last two presidential elections, Le Pen was beaten fairly comfortably by Macron both times? What needs to change between now and 2027?
Well, I'm tempted to say not much, which I don't really believe. But, you know, there's a poll in yesterday's Le Figaro that says that if there were a snap election in France now, they would win. So the resentment against Macron, which was always one of the elements about him, because I don't think any French president has been personally resented so much as Emmanuel Macron. There were moments when Sarkozy was not liked, but this has gone into a different sphere. And right now they're doing the wrong thing. And even when Macron is finally doing the right thing, like, for instance, on Ukraine, he does it the wrong way, which is he suddenly sort of, you know, you must have followed the controversy at the end of the Paris Ukraine meeting conference of 5 hours at the Élysée 2 weeks ago. And at the end, Macron comes out and there's a press conference and he says nothing is off the table, not even sending ground troops, troops on the ground in Ukraine. Well, his partners, and there were heads of states and head of government, had not heard that one. So it was a big surprise and they immediately contradicted him. But also that was the thing that gives so much more sort of arguments to Marine Le Pen that it would be disastrous for France. It is also something that the Ukrainians hastened to say they never wanted. They would like, you know, they'd like ammunition and weapons. They do not necessarily, they don't want European EU boots on the ground. And those things, Macron thinks that he can say it, and he literally used the expression when his people started sort of telling, you know, for feeding us, you know, belatedly why he was doing this. They said, but he's attempting a Trumpian disruption, quote unquote, and he's attempting a Trumpian disruption that would be useful because, for instance, when Trump said that NATO should contribute, each NATO country should contribute 2% of their GDP in defense, it was found out that it was perfectly true. But I don't think it was, you know, it was Macron doing this for himself to look that way. And I've had feedback from the people who were at that conference who were horrified. But the feedback in France is we have, you know, we there's more feeling pro-Ukraine in France except for a small but, you know, still sort of politically determinant fringe that's pro-Russian, but mostly France is in sympathy with Ukraine. But that's a massive thing between that and sending troops on the ground. So Macron thinks that these things are forgotten because he turns to something else. But I think it's cumulative. Even if it's not in the news, even if it doesn't appear in the polls, he has accumulated something that screeches to people, do not vote for me. And I think they don't have much more to do. They need to be better on economics. They need to be less perceived. The National Rally got two loans from Putin for their campaigns, presidential campaigns, 2017 and 2022. It is understandable because French banks virtue signaled and they refused to give them loans, considering that this is the party that polls the most in France, and they're perfectly legal. There's no way you can defend that, and that's it's really, I mean, it's even more on par than the debanking of Nigel Farage. But it's, you know, it's the system in France right now. But I don't think they have much more to do. I think it's almost a shoo-in.
May I just add one thing? I agree absolutely with analysis, and it's not just Macron. It's also the uselessness of the other parties and the extremism. So look, La France and Soumise, that's the party of Jean-Luc Mélenchon, sort of often likened to the Gallic Jeremy Corbyn, some of their rhetoric and behaviour has alienated a lot of people and made helped in the demonisation of the National Rally, as has, of course, Eric Zimmel, who's far more to the right than Marine Le Pen or Jordan Bardella. So all these factors mean that, as Aaron Smith says, we don't actually need to do that much, because to a great extent, their opponents are doing a lot for them.
Well, Gavin and Anne Elizabeth, thank you very much indeed for joining me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we get to our final section, is there anything else, Gus, you'd like to highlight from the magazine?
Yeah, there was a letter by a gentleman called Trevor Cooper, who wrote in about Matthew Paris's column last week titled How to Claim Mental Illness Benefits. And in it, Mr. Cooper says, "Sir, the article by Matthew Paris is eye-opening. One particular fact jolted me, that assessors are not allowed to access the claimant's health records. Why not? And it seems to me like quite a reasonable point. If you're going to, you know, ask the state, you know, for support, for financial support, it only seems right that the assessors can look at your medical history and work out whether or not the claims that you're making are backed up, you know, by doctors."
Yeah. No, very, very good point from Mr. Cooper. Thank you for writing in.
And finally, why do theatre directors feel they need to correct Shakespeare? That's the question that Lloyd Evans asks in the magazine this week. He says that directors should go back to basics when it comes to adapting the Bard and leave the gimmicks to one side. To discuss this, we were joined by Yael Farber, who is currently directing King Lear at the Almeida and has previously adapted Macbeth and Julius Caesar. I started by asking Yael, first of all, what attracts her to Shakespeare?
The reach of the writing is it has so much space around it, and yet it has that extraordinary specificity. So you know, particularly in the big tragedies, and King Lear would be the fourth one that I've done, there is a capacity to encompass the domestic and the national. And then when you add, there's a sense of the political, the psychological, the spiritual, and with each of these works, you almost as a director have to try and decide where you're going to focus, because it's so expansive what's possible with the works. And it's a cliche to say it, but there's such an immediacy about the work once you get past decoding the language. And I think that's really about the actors just having a real capacity with understanding what they're saying. It's quite extraordinary how they touch on, all these works touch on contemporary realities today.
In Lloyd's piece, he laments the fact that he thinks that directors often feel the need to meddle with Shakespeare. Perhaps that plays into what you're saying about how expansive Shakespeare can be. Do you think Lloyd has a point that perhaps some of that expansiveness can lead to scenarios where directors feel that they are improving Shakespeare, or perhaps putting something on top of Shakespeare that's not actually there?
I do tend to agree that I think the only reason to really go in on Shakespeare with the intention of recontextualizing is to illuminate it. You know, you get extraordinary artists, Ostermeyer, etc. You know, I mean, I think the Europeans are quite good at opening up the texts in a way that it becomes almost a kind of allegory. And because the society, very often the audiences, have such a reference point on really what the myth is, it almost becomes mythical. It becomes an intellectual exercise to unwrap them in a different way. But for me, it's the productions that get caught in the middle ground, where they are actually trying to create a time and place that almost becomes too specific and becomes a kind of imposition on the work and obfuscates the work rather than illuminating it.
How do you approach Shakespeare when you're approached for a new production?
The same way I approach any play, which is how do I plug this, almost like mainline it into a sense of urgency and necessity for why? I mean, I always ask the question, why is it necessary or important to stage this work in this moment now? For me, I have to feel a certain sense of urgency. around that, so societally, politically, psychologically, whatever it is, that it feels like some kind of real offering to the community, being the witnesses who come to see it, rather than an exercise in cleverness. To me, it's really about unwrapping it at every level. How do I reveal what the original intention was in the most vital and exciting and urgent way?
And when there are decisions which stray from how the play is written, so for example, in your production of King Lear at the Almeida, which was given an extremely positive review by Hannah Tomes in The Spectator a couple of weeks ago, she writes in the review that the closing lines of the play, which are usually attributed to Edgar, are given to the fool in your production. So I wonder, when it comes to decisions like that, slightly changing parts of the text or who's saying what, I mean, how are those decisions reached? And are you ever concerned about how perhaps purists might react to those sorts of decisions?
I don't concern myself with purists only because, you know, if you over-concern yourself with anything other than an intuition as an artist, in terms of contemporary opinions, you can lose your way. But first of all, the closing lines of the play in some editions are attributed to Albany and in some are attributed to Edgar. So already between the in the folio, it might differ. But in fact, I give the first two lines of the four remaining lines to Edgar and the very last two to the fool. And that's because, you know, it's the same as the witches in Macbeth. The fool is a device that we won't entirely understand today. It was an absolutely implicit part of court life, and people would have had a very clear reference of who the fool was in Elizabethan life, which is, you know, someone employed by in the king's employment who had license to say anything. In fact, it was his job to speak the absolute unnerving truth. And because we don't necessarily have that as an understanding today, it becomes like with the witches in Macbeth when I did that show 2 years ago. How do I unwrap this concept in a way that we can understand now? And the fool in my recent production of King Lear is actually an iteration of either Lear's madness or an imagined friend or a kind of truncated part of his own unconscious. But any which way you turn it, it is still someone who is speaking unnerving truths to Lear. And so him coming back with the final lines would tie it in and give him a complete trajectory. You know, I think, one also has to consider that there are so many ways to interpret these texts because stage directions were absolutely to the minimum when they were finally, recorded and set down. And so there is a vast amount of possibility for interpretation. But, you know, for me, for example, when I directed The Crucible at the Old Vic, to me, that's already a story. I just use this as an example of Miller already allegorized. He used the context of Salem, 1692, to talk about McCarthyism in America in the 50s. And so in a moment like that, I would find it irrelevant to re-allegorize something that is already an allegory. Whereas when I did Miss Julie, I wanted to entirely recontextualize it, and I did into South Africa, because all I'm really interested in is what was so stunningly shocking or extraordinary as a truth about this play when it was written. It's kind of forensic for me. How do I uncover what's there and make it possible, make alive the devices that the playwright was using at the time?
So when you go and see Shakespeare productions as a theatre goer rather than a director, do you sometimes feel that what you're watching is an imposition on the text, that it is yes, actually it hasn't done this excavation that you're talking about and bringing something out of it. It has in fact gone from the top down, so to speak.
Yes, I do feel that if I am thinking more about what decisions the director made rather than allowing the play to have an effect on me, or the play having an effect on me, then I feel that there has been some kind of imposition. Now, I have a very particular way of working aesthetically. So, very often what I do becomes very, very prominent, but I'm always aspiring to to reveal ultimately what the playwright was doing. Whereas I do sometimes feel that I am watching productions that become more about the director, almost in competition with the playwright.
So should you, in an ideal world, would you not be thinking about the director at all? Would you not notice the director if you're when watching?
Correct. Correct. Yes, or can be an extraordinary collaboration between a director's vision and the playwright's intention. But I think once the playwright's intention gets obscured in the director's vision, for me personally, I do think that is problematic. I want to be in touch with, I want to be in conversation with what the playwright intended.
Yeah, Elle, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. Thank you.
You're most welcome.
And that's it for this week. As ever, we're always looking to improve the podcast and the format, so please do keep your comments coming in. They're very helpful. If you'd like to tell us how we're doing, send an email to podcast@spectator.co.uk. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, pick up a copy of The Spectator magazine to read everything we've talked about in full. I'm William Moore.
And I'm Gus Carter. And thank you for joining us.